And the winner is the bear from The Revenant.
That didn't come out right. Let me try again. This isn't going well. I don't have my glasses. I can't read my notes. What I should do is thank some people. What are the names of some people? The audience actually looks a little scared to me. I mainly want to thank, what are the food people called? Craft Services? They always brought salmon for me. And Kit Kats for dessert. I usually have 25 of them. What were the names of the Craft Services people? I think there was one named Stacy and Daryl? I might have accidentally mauled him and sent him to the hospital because the yellow fruit was touching the red fruit on the fruit plate. I hate that. I'm getting the wrap it up signal. Don't movies have directors? Which person was the director on this one? And there were definitely some actors. I mean, they have to have names, right? But the only people who meant anything to me were the people who gave me food. Everything else went by in a blur. Why don't I face that about myself? I'm a bear. I have a different hierarchy of needs. Oh, God, now I'm getting a signal that I should introduce some kind of a radio show. Well, here goes. And now the guy who tastes like Kit Kats, really old, stale Kit Kats, Colin McEnroe.
We're live from the study in New Haven, Connecticut. We're here in sort of our second home here in New Haven, Connecticut. It's the study at Yale, the wonderful hotel here on Chapel Street. If you're hearing this broadcast and, you know, you're nearby, come on down. We've got a few empty seats, but not many here in the lobby. And this is our annual show about the Oscars. We do the nose on the Friday before the Oscars every year the same way. One of our great traditions is having Vivian Nebeta, who I think has done it every single time for us, from the Stowe Center now, also winner of this year's Best Shoes Award. Tom Breen's very upset. He thought he had really good shoes today, and then he just walked in.
And I was the favorite coming in.
Yeah, so Vivian Nevada here is with us. Tom Breen is a reporter for the New Haven Independent and hosts a film show on WNHH here in New Haven called Deep Focus. That's what it's called?
That's correct.
Yeah. And then the guy who's really in the business here, Arnold Gorlick, is the owner of Madison Art Cinemas in Madison, Connecticut. He's the guy who really has to live and breathe this stuff. So that's who's here. We're going to have a conversation. If we have some time, maybe we can get the audience involved as well. But maybe the way to begin, and I'll start with you, Arnold. Why do we do this every year? I mean, in some ways, the Oscars are invariably a source of frustration. We spend a lot of time talking about errors they made, either in making nominations or who ultimately wins them. The movies that we often care very passionately about are not involved at all. So what's the, do the Academy Awards have any purpose? I suppose as a theater owner, for you, they have a purpose in sort of focusing people's attention on certain things.
I think fundamentally you have to look at the Oscars as a marketing tool and not have higher expectations that it's anything but that, to promote itself, to promote as many films. I try to say movies now. There's no more film. Yeah. As many movies as possible. We could also look at the absurdity of things, even in the Golden Globes, when The Martian won for Best Comedy. This is clearly a move to market. It has nothing to do with merit or categorizing things correctly.
Now, Vivian, you're somebody who loves movies. What do you get out of the Oscars? Anything except irritation?
I think I probably said it before on other shows. It's really a chance for the Academy to pat itself on the back and kind of feel very self-important. So part of what you do is you kind of hate watch a little bit. And I know I'm not the only one. I see a couple people nodding. I know this year's a little more contentious as far as watching or not watching, but and I'm not going to lie, I do like to see pretty dresses. Don't judge me, please.
So how about for you, Tom Breen? Is this a totally discredited spectacle at this point, or does it have some intrinsic worth?
So I don't think it's just hate watching that we can look forward to when it comes to the Oscars. I think this is an annual checkup on how the movie industry is doing in this country and internationally. You're right, it is a marketing ploy, and it is, you know, meant to draw a lot of attention to a very small set of movies. But also, this Oscars so white hashtag that everyone in the country has been talking about for the past 2 months, is because of the Oscars. It's because of shows like this that chat about the Oscars and their relative cultural importance. So it is a chance for us, as people who watch movies and think about movies, to, you know, diagnose the state of the movie industry as we see it and maybe hate watch a little bit.
So, first of all, obviously, Oscars So White in some ways has been beaten to death over the last 2 months, and there's a case to be made that it's all talked out. On the other hand, I feel as though it's so egregious, it's so bad that we can't let them off the hook yet for this. I mean, we still have to talk about this. We still have to talk about this gigantic error. And so, Arnold, this is something, I mean, in some ways you look at this and you think, well, it's the result of a balloting. It's not something that anybody can control. But it does seem to be the result of some kind of strange set of attitudes embedded in the film business. You can argue that, well, maybe the biggest problem is not who gets nominated or who gets awards, but what films get made, who gets cast in what films. But there's a fundamental, I mean, you and I were just saying this before we went on the air today. For me, I mean, the movie that affected me the most this year, that I got the most pleasure out of, that I thought was just a fabulous piece of filmmaking, was Creed. I'm not in any doubt about whether a mistake was made here. Michael B. Jordan should be up as best actor. That movie should be up as best film. And Ryan Coogler should be up as best director.
Well, it's interesting because by honoring only Sylvester Stallone, it really highlights in bold relief what an egregious error this is. Sylvester Stallone is a talented man. He created a franchise that's essentially one note. Mm. He's not one of the great actors. It's not one of the great performances. And by elevating him to the level of a nomination and omitting Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan just highlights in bold relief. And it has to go to the basic, I think a part of it is subliminal tendency in the Hollywood movie business, that movies about black people, African Americans, are considered what old records used to be considered race records. Old jazz records were considered race records to a limited crowd. Mm. I could talk later about comparing two movies, Blindside and Precious. One by a white director that went on to great Hollywood success, and one by an African-American director, Lee Daniels, in Precious, which, although fiction, was a far more authentic and believable rendering of the entrapment of urban poor.
And let me ask you something, Vivian, because I was sitting there watching Creed, and...
Which was awesome, by the way.
Yeah, okay. And one of the things that I was thinking, and which has absolutely no value whatsoever coming from a 61-year-old white guy, I was thinking, watching the scenes between Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson, I was thinking, I feel like I'm watching two young African-American adults talk and interact in a way that if I were a young African-American adult, I'd think, oh, I recognize that. I recognize the way that they're talking and interacting. It felt for me very natural and natural looking. But then what do I know about that?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe part of, to kind of dovetail what people have been talking about in terms of movies, I think that because there's just Creed, which I loved, and I do think that they had a really beautiful relationship. I think it could have been explored more, and I get it, that's not necessarily the point of the movie. But I also think that it's a nice reminder that you can just be people in a relationship, and that I think it reminds people that there is a need and that there's a want for broader stories to be told, and for the fact that I think that Creed is the only movie we're talking about which only was nominated for Sylvester Stallone also says a lot. Mm. So I think it shows that there's a lot that we still have to do, but I think it also, what I liked about it is that it felt like a pretty relationship. I hate to use that word pretty because it's, what does it mean? It's kind of like nice, but you didn't look at it and didn't feel like you couldn't associate with it.
Yeah, Tom, what were you going to say?
I think the naturalness of the relationship between Tessa Thompson and Michael B. Jordan Creed is really testament to the care and subtlety that director Ryan Coogler brings to his depictions of race. I mean, I think that Fruitvale Station, his first picture, which is about Oscar Grant III, the young man who was shot and killed on the platform of a San Francisco BART station, deals with the conflict, the normalness of living your life as a black man in America, and then the explosion of violence that comes out of... you have all of these little minor inconveniences, annoyances, prejudices, and then all of a sudden you find yourself face first on the platform and you're shot. And I think that what Creed does, you're right, it shows, you know, here's a normal character. Here's a character that anyone can relate to. He's inheriting, you know, the mantle from Sylvester Stallone. He's passing on this franchise to him. But also the moments where the kind of race explodes into the picture for me in a really positive way is that scene in North Philadelphia when he's running through the streets and the kids behind him are racing on these dirt bikes and ATVs. And these are kids who are hungry for, you know, a role model. They see Apollo Creed, you know, this fallen person as their hero, and they're looking for someone to replace him. And here in Michael B. Jordan, they find someone who they can really look up to and who understands them. And I found that very racially specific, and that is talking about the response of a minority neighborhood, but also just beautiful.
It is the only positive depiction of urban ATVs you will ever see, because in real life, they're real a pain in the neck. If you're ever driving around a city and they're anywhere near you, you spend the entire time trying not to kill them by mistake. So so that artistically was an accomplishment to make that almost balletic in what they did.
If I may throw in one more thing about art. So often Oscars So White and our conversation about movies that have been, you know, conspicuously overlooked by the Oscars, Creed is at the top of the list, and then a close second is Straight Outta Compton. I mean, the Washington Post did a number of kind of pseudo-analyses of the makeup of the Academy, and they found it was like 90% white, 90% male, 90% over 60, 90%, you know, everything that this country's
kind of
moving away from. One of the people in the Academy dismisses Straight Outta Compton because it was, quote-unquote, too loud, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not going to see Straight Outta Compton because the volume of the noise, then you're not probably in the, you know, business to evaluate music biopics. But one movie that has not been talked about in this kind of negative space of overlooked is Chirac. I think Chirac was one of the best movies of the year.
This is Spike Lee's movie.
Spike Lee's movie, an adaptation of an ancient Greek satire about, you know, sex withheld until the violence stops. And it got a very mixed response from critics and audiences, everyone else. But I think that should be in the conversation for, you know, with Creed and Straight Outta Compton as movies by people of color, about people of color, that were horribly overlooked.
Well, we're having our typical Oscar show. We're talking about movies that haven't been nominated for the first 10 minutes, instead of the ones that have. So we probably should actually talk a little bit about the nominations. Can we talk about Best Picture? I'll lay my cards on the table. Given what's nominated, after I saw The Revenant, for me this year, the criterion is what's being done with the medium of movies here. In other words, is this an especially good movie as opposed to something that would be easily transferable to another medium? Are they doing something that only movies can do? And I'm actually pretty comfortable with The Revenant winning on that basis. I feel it does enough with the medium. It excites me enough in that way that you know, if something here has to win, that's fine with me. But so, Arnold, I know Brooklyn for you is the...
Well, it's not. I don't wish for it to win. It was my personal favorite. I'm from Brooklyn. Part of my youth was overseen by Irish people, and I have a wife who had to choose between two homes and chose to be with me. The three themes in Brooklyn, and I lived around the corner from where Ebbetsfield used to be, one of the subtexts in Brooklyn. So this is my personal favorite. I don't think it deserves to be Best Picture of the Year. The one I would hope to win would be Spotlight, but The Revenant does something that's different than all the other movies. It fully exploits the possibilities of movies, of film, in a way that you can only see this in a movie theater to appreciate it. Anybody sees this at home is not going to see The Revenant.
Yeah, I mean, every year there's a few movies like that.
And
don't
that,
bother.
It means a great deal to me that this has to be a cinematic experience in a movie theater.
Right. I would imagine that would mean something to you. What about you, Vivian? How does the category shape up for you?
I think I agree with you. It's probably going to be The Revenant. I think we already know, even if you haven't seen it, I'm just going to spoil it for you now. I'm going to bet Leonardo DiCaprio is going to win. I think the Oscar gods have just kind of, which is probably another topic of discussion, there always seems to line up, like, this person, it is their time to receive the anointed Oscar. And as we all know, there's been a lot of talk, like, oh, he's never gotten it, and there's a long list of people who never gotten it and should, but so spoiler alert, Leonardo DiCaprio is going to win.
Tom, just how's the category look
for you? Well, actually, I want to say that I think it's an incredibly strong category when it comes to Best Picture. I mean, there is not a dud in the bunch. I think any of these movies is worthy of that type of recognition. But dwelling on The Revenant for a second more, you had an episode about the art of the critic yesterday, and mm-hmm. it's nice to follow A.O. Scott. It's a bit intimidating. Yeah. But you played this clip from Birdman, which won Best Picture last year, in which Michael Keaton, who plays a long-suffering actor, is railing against a critic. Right? He says, "You don't take risks. I'm an artist. I take risks. It's risky being me." And I think that what we're seeing in The Revenant is a director taking a big risk, subjecting an audience to 3 hours of grueling punishment and beautiful images, and I don't think that it's ultimately a successful movie. I found especially the latter 2 hours, I found horribly, pretentious and grueling, but it is a movie that cannot be, it's a work of art that couldn't be realized in any other format. I don't know if that's the only thing that we should look to when we celebrate movies.
No, it's probably not the only thing we should look to. Although one of the things that people repeat, I had this experience, many of you probably had the experience, by about an hour and a half in, I was really cold. I was actually really cold. I wish I'd worn double layers of socks and things like that. So for a movie to be able to do that, actually make you experience that. I mean,
in a way that The Hateful Eight didn't. No. I didn't feel cold during that. I felt cold during The Revenant.
And maybe it is just the relentlessness that you're talking about.
I don't want to give away any spoilers, but we have to think about how a movie sticks its landing, too. And for one that dwells so much on the futility of these revenge exercises and then maybe letting the character off the hook a bit at the end, it seemed a bit contradictory. It didn't seem to be too confident in the ultimate idea it was trying to convey to the audience and more reveling in the beauty and the bloodshed.
I mean, I know that Arnold saw it, and I saw it also this morning. There's a piece up on the New Yorker website by Richard Brody talking about basically the politics of this, and that, The Revenant is kind of the Trump of the movies, that it's crude, it's visceral, it's raw, and it's
bombastic.
It makes up its own rules, too. Right. I mean, this is ultimately about making up your own rule about how you're going to deal with something. Mm-hmm. Did you say Spotlight is what you'd like to see win or think is going to win?
Spotlight, I don't think will win because of its understatement, but in many ways, Spotlight to me was a perfect movie. There wasn't a wasted frame. There wasn't an extra syllable. They even managed to make the tedium of the work they did engaging. Certainly, it's the best movie on journalism since All the President's Men. Mm. And its understatement and its gradual power, as you see the protagonist, even not fully be able to assimilate what was happening as it was happening, ultimately bringing the number of abusing priests to 249 and Cardinal Bernard's role in it and how he was handled by the church. This was, to me, a brave movie, understated. It's also non-individualistic. It's an ensemble piece. Nobody stands out. It's the group. It's the idea of what really a collaborative effort movie making it is. For its understatement, I don't think it'll win, but I think it was a courageous movie.
So I'm going to introduce one of my theories of culture. I only have like 3 or 4 of them, and I just say them over and over again, hoping that people have forgotten the last time I said them. So one of my theories of culture is that we celebrate a thing when it's dying. And this, you can kind of connect this to The Revenant in the sense that, it's a movie about a kind of frontier that's gone, about a kind of Native American existence that's completely driven out. But more than that, it sort of connects to, the Wild West shows. The Wild Bill Hickok type of Wild West shows became very popular in America at precisely the time the frontier that it was celebrating, that they were celebrating, was settling down and going out of business. And you see this over and over again. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, there were all these shows like Twin Peaks and Northern Exposure and Picket Fences, and they were all about the kind of idiosyncratic small American town that was being extinguished by Boston Markets and CVSs and this kind of DNA code that repeats itself in American life now. And one of the things that I think vivid about Spotlight is I'm watching the celebration of something that I'm witnessing the death of right now, which is newspaper journalism, investigative journalism, the deployment of LARC. I mean, the scene near the beginning where Liev Schreiber arrives as the new editor and asks Michael Keaton, "Well, how is it you do your job?" And he says, "Well, it takes us a couple of months maybe to pick something we're going to do, and then we might work on it for a year or two." You just realize you might as well be listening to a conversation about the Wild West. I mean, this isn't going to be happening anymore.
Right. Well, I also wonder, to your point about kind of celebrating things as they're dying, I never thought of it that way, actually, and I think you're right, because since this movie has come out, there has been a lot of discussion about journalism and what does that mean anymore, because how many places can you go for long-form, really in-depth writing, and you really can't. And some of it, you know, it is kind of like we're at that weird kind of cultural turning point, because you think about it, when something happens, there's breaking news, there's so many ways in which you can get it, but we don't have any more places that analyze something after it's done. So we don't have an understanding of where we're going as a culture, so I never really thought of it that way. And I think part of what I think might be an issue for Spotlight is the subject matter. I mean, it's a tough thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's a tough group that is involved in that, and I think for some people, and out of all the movies that are in that, I think there are a lot of underdogs, but I certainly feel like there was probably a group of people in the general public that were like, what movie is this? Mm. Who? What is this? So,
but it is a movie that
there's a lot there.
A highly charged subject that was not salacious and not sensational.
Right.
It was not a sensationalized.
Exactly.
It didn't sensationalize the.
Right, and even with The Revenant, yes, it was 3 hours, and it was very brutal and pushing, but it wasn't the same thing as sitting through a Spotlight on that particular topic. Mm-hmm. I think it feels, and I hate to say it this way, I think it feels maybe more palatable to somebody to go and watch Leonardo DiCaprio have that experience as opposed to let me go sit through a movie where we talk about children who unfortunately have been molested.
It's about 50-50. I mean? It's palatability 50-50. Yeah. Although, Tom, one feeling that I have, though, is, okay, we use movies to dream, too, to dream and to see things that we hope, the way we wish things were, or what the possibilities that seem to elude us can be transferred up onto the screen. And I feel as though with some of these movies, you know, I mean, we go back to the, I think it was the Ron Suskin book where during the Bush administration, somebody who appeared to be Karl Rove said, oh, you're back in the reality-based community. And we live right now in a situation where the search for truth is often shunted to one side. Donald Trump gets up and just says something that he kind of thinks is true, that Muslims were celebrating at 9/11 across the river in Jersey City. It doesn't seem to need to be fact-checked. And that some of these movies are Spotlight and The Martian, to whatever extent we think The Martian is kind of competence porn about people who are obviously products of the Enlightenment, who still believe in facts and science. There's a recurring phrase in The Martian, which I can't say on the radio, but we're going to science the blank out of this, that one of the dreams that's in some of these movies is there are still competent people working at the Boston Globe or working for NASA, you know, who know things and stick to the facts and stick to the science. And maybe that's one of the dreams we're celebrating this year.
I think that's the appeal and success of Bridge of Spies as well, where you have an insurance lawyer who's kind of brokering the Cold War. He's this incredibly competent small person causing monumental changes. But going back to your I appreciate your one of your theories on culture, this thing about our interest in dying institutions. But I think that a movie or any work of art that relies solely upon that type of nostalgia can only go so far. I think Spotlight is really of a moment with this Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, absolute frustration and lack of trust in elites, in elites who are corrupt, in elites who have been taking advantage of little people for eons. And in Spotlight, you see a Catholic Church and a municipal government hand in hand perpetuating this crime against the community. And I think that part of the appeal of Spotlight for me is that surging up against these institutions that otherwise, I mean, Spotlight did such a great job for such a modest movie of having every single scene backdropped by a church. It's almost walled in, this church community of Boston. You can't turn without looking at one of those churches. And to rebel against these big institutions, that's why I had Spotlight at the top of my list as well.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break here. We'll come back with more of this terrific panel live from the study in New Haven right after this.
All of the family, so take this suggestion from me.
Oh, let's go out to the movies. They're better than ever before.
With romance to thrill you and mystery to chill you.
From the study in New Haven, activate our applause sound effects. I'm I'm kidding. It's not a sign effect. We actually have human beings here. Lovely, attractive, wonderful Elm City human beings are here. We're at the Study in New Haven on Chapel Street, a beautiful hotel here in New Haven. We're talking about the Oscars with Arnold Gorlick. He is the owner of Madison Art Cinemas. With Vivian Nebeta, who has never not been with us for an Oscar episode of The Nose. She's with the Stowe Center now. And Tom Breen, who is a reporter for the New Haven Independent and perhaps more relevantly, the host of Deep Focus on WNHH down here in New Haven. So we want to spend a little moment or two talking about the documentaries. And Tom decided it would be really fun for us if, like, we watched this movie called The Look of Silence, which I watched last night and then turned over to the Republican debate and thought, our country is really in trouble right now. But so maybe just set it up for us, Tom. Tell us about The Look of Silence.
Sure. So The Look of Silence is the second movie by Danish filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer about the kind of long-standing consequences of the Indonesian genocide in 1965, which there was a military coup, and the military government killed over 1 million suspected communists. But that meant ethnic Chinese, that meant people who were, you know, in opposition parties to the government, that meant anyone who happened to be on the wrong side of the aisle or looked the wrong way, you were killed. And this is, so The Look of Silence is the perspective on this genocide from the victim's point of view. So the filmmaker follows around the brother of someone who was killed during the genocide, and this brother, who is an eye doctor and you know, an eyeglass salesman, he goes around to find these people who led the death squads, who participated in this genocide, who are still revered in Indonesia today, and many of them still hold power in this country. So he, this brother of the victim and the filmmaker, they go kind of from door to door to all these people who spend most of their time boasting about how many people they could kill or how they rid this country of communists. And he says, listen, when you are in power and you don't recognize that a whole community of people still live in fear of another genocide breaking out because of the way you boast about this, this is not a sustainable way for people to live. And I think watching it in juxtaposition with the Republican debate is uncannily familiar, because when we think about the atrocities in our own American history that we have not come to terms with, I mean, slavery being the biggest one, how is it that we can really prosper as a society with everyone involved, included in that prosperity, when one group still feels under the thumb of, you know, the monster of circularity, right? As Richard Brody talked about the Academy, white people promoting other white people who like movies by white people.
Well, yeah, no, and I gave you an impossible job, which is to just describe this movie, which is kind of an indescribable movie. It is a movie that nothing that you could say about it would prepare, I think, people for these incredibly strange conversations. And I was kind of joking. I mean, at the end of it, you do see, as Tom has said, this moment in 1965 where things got really, really out of control, and it could be argued have never gotten back under control ever since. And there is a way in which you think, well, wow, once the monster's out of the box, you can't really get it back in all that easily. And I'm sort of kidding that when I flipped over to the Republican debate, I thought, oh, we're in a lot of trouble. And I certainly don't think we're in that kind of trouble. But you realize there are a lot of people who are waiting to feel empowered, you know, and not for nothing. But, I mean, David Duke just announced himself a supporter of Donald Trump and said he wants all of his followers, God help us, however many of those there might be.
And the American Nazi Party.
And you just sort of think, maybe we do see movies like this as a warning anyway about what happens when you don't take something like that seriously.
And I just last thing on Look of Silence, this is the second movie. First one is called Act of Killing, which is told from the perspective of the killers themselves. So
there's also the issue of forgiveness. It's such an enigmatic thing. Was he forgiving? He so wanted this man, this brother of Romley, who was brutalized and killed after two attempts and among the genocide at the side of the Snake River. His eagerness to forgive, mainly because he wanted to free himself from it, but was he forgiving too easily? He reminded me more of a quote that I think was attributed to Heloise and Abelard. Heloise said to him, I dreamt that someone gave good for evil, and the world stood still. Otherwise, I couldn't fathom why he could summon up the will to forgive, even in the face of no apology.
You know, Vivian, every year this happens. There are movies in the documentary category that really do sort of ask us profound questions about living, call our attention to situations far away from us across the globe, bring up breathtakingly complex moral questions. And then there's movies about entertainment. And for the most part, those tend to win. Those tend to do much better. And so this year, we've got Amy Winehouse and we've got Nina Simone. And I'm guessing that the Academy probably breaks that way as opposed to this incredibly difficult movie we're talking about right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think just listening to it, and I have to admit I haven't seen it yet, because again, I have to admit sometimes I'm that person that I don't mind. I believe in that art should push you, and that you should watch something and you should be uncomfortable. But I would be surprised if a lot of the members of the Academy, whoever they are, we know what they might look like, have seen that. So you do tend to go to things like, okay, well, I know who Amy Winehouse is. Not to say the quality of the work isn't very good, because I saw the Nina Simone documentary, and for me, particularly in this discussion about, you know, Oscar so white and the point culturally where we are, to watch the Nina Simone documentary, one, I mean, I know who she is because, you know, I hope all of us here know who she is, but to really be able to delve into her life and find out who she was. And I actually watched something where the filmmaker talked about how open her daughter was to whatever she wanted to do, that she didn't put any kind of limitations on what could be said or what could be not said. And I didn't realize that I knew she was an activist, I knew she was very vocal, and I knew she took a lot of hits for how she felt and what she believed. And I couldn't help but think, well, what if she was around today? Mm-hmm. Like, what if she was here today and she sang that Mississippi, and I'm not going to say the end of the song, today? Would she take that same hit? And, you know, there's a lot of kind of, and I think that because culture and because this discussion of entertainers and musicians, they do kind of dovetail into how we're living our lives, because I of course had to make that comparison when I thought about after I watched the documentary with Beyonce and the Formation video. Actually, that's one of the things I talked about. I know that's Colin's favorite video, he said it. But how for me, kind of thought, okay, well, if she was to do that today, who would she be? Would she still be successful? Because she didn't. Not that she wasn't an artist, and not that her legacy doesn't live on, but once she spoke out the way she did, it was like, oh, nope, that's it, your career's done. And to a certain degree, we live in a culture where that might not necessarily be the case. So that's what I thought about.
I don't know whether, I think it has something to do with the moment that we're in here in America, but it's almost impossible to see these movies this year and not refract them through the present moment. I mean,
exactly.
Just in the way that you're saying, or, you know, I mean, Cartel Land is one of the other documentaries that's nominated this year. And there's, at the beginning of Cartel Land, you basically see the guys that Donald Trump thinks are all of the Mexican immigrants, right? You see those guys, and it's just an amazing shot. And then they have a conversation to the camera. One guy talks to camera, and he says, look, this is what we have to do. You know, if we lived up where you live and we had the kind of opportunities that you have, we probably wouldn't be doing this right now. You know, we'd be doing something else. We'd be doing whatever it is that you do. But this is what we have to do. And there are, like, so many things going on just at that moment. One of them is, well, yeah, that's not what our Mexican immigration problem is about, Donald Trump notwithstanding. But also, just, you're nodding, I assume you saw this. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did. And I think it's important to bring up Sicario in conjunction with Cartel Land, two movies this year that really dealt very well with the border, with the kind of border as an idea and the very real kind of threatening aspect of the U.S.-Mexican border. I mean, this subject of the border, the kind of ambiguity that surrounds it, is stuff that, you know, the filmmaker John Sayles has been making movies about for a long time, where you live in Texas, California, Florida, you're kind of near the kind of outskirts, the fringes of the United States, and what does that do to both your community and also to your own ego? But with Cartel Land, I mean, it did such a great job, right, of identifying the cycles of vigilante justice and what vigilante justice looks like in a country like Mexico, where there actually is rampant corruption in government and where people actually do have to pick up guns and defend themselves, mm-hmm. and then what it looks like on the other side of the Arizona border, where you have a bunch of people who are, you know, watching Fox News, getting riled up, angry at their dad, and arresting people who, you know, are just working in their local restaurants because they see it as an infringement of their rights as Americans. It's a real debunking of what vigilante justice means in a country that doesn't need it anymore.
So, Arnold, one thing that people down here tell me about you is that if you live here down in the southern part of the state, that Arnold Gorlick will make sure you see certain movies. That, for example, Mark Oppenheimer was passing through here a little while ago. He says, yeah, Arnold will say, you've got to come see this movie. It's important that you come to my movie theater and see this movie. So are there movies right now that, not necessarily the ones you're playing this very minute, but movies that are part of this conversation that you feel that way about, that you want up on your screen, that you want to make people see because you think it'll change them somehow?
Oddly enough, that's really the point of view from which I operate the theater, but I don't feel that strongly about anything. Of course, The Look of Silence, but I'm not going to play The Look of Silence, it looked like. Mm. It's a for-profit theater. I have to be able to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. I always fantasize of being not-for-profit because I can go more to the edge, but I haven't been rewarded. At this moment, no. But what I do differently than other theaters is I make curtain appearances before movies when occasionally there's a movie that's so transformative that it's affecting me so much, not to create box office. I just share with them that you must come and sit in a darkened movie theater and have this transforming experience. That's what gives meaning to what I do.
And just to sort of put a little button on that, too, one thing you and I were talking about during the break is with documentaries, a lot of them are going direct to video these days, too. There's, you know, your first chance to see them is on Netflix as opposed to...
And that's part of the subtext of what's going on with the whiteness of the Oscars. Idris Elba, for example, had not been nominated. Mm-hmm. The Beast of No Nation has not been nominated. And many people trivialize it because it's really coming out on, where we watch it on a television screen first, on Netflix, and it doesn't have quite the same credibility. I mentioned to you that years ago, Hoop Dreams, which I thought should have not only been nominated for Best Documentary, but have won, but instead a very fine documentary, which was done on film about Maya Lin, is the one, and there was a huge controversy about it, that something that's done on video was trivialized, and the Hollywood industry won't give it the same credence as something that's done to be shown in movie theaters.
Well, technically, they released it enough. But I would agree with you that there still is that, oh, you can, you know, movies are movies because you have to go and pay for the experience, whereas television is something that you can do at your own home. But I would argue that, and that's another show, that television is doing a much better job in terms of, it's not perfect either, but it's doing a much better job.
The best writing is now on television, yeah. It's true.
And I would also argue that as somebody who doesn't, before we lived in a world that unless you had a certain cinema that would show documentaries, you'd never see one. So I think with things like Netflix and Amazon Prime, they've given access to a lot of people who would not have seen some of these films. So I think that's kind of maybe a double-edged sword in a lot of ways. But I think it's opened up documentaries to people who probably wouldn't have had the chance.
Well, I mean, The Look of Silence, case in point, right? I mean, that's going to be, as you say, it's a tough movie for you to show. You're not going to get crowds. Up where we live at Real Artways, they show movies like that. But by and large, that's also a movie where, yeah, you watch it on a 46-inch television, you're probably not going to lose too much of the visual quality.
Right, although we shouldn't diminish the kind of cinematic nature of the movie as well. I mean, this isn't just a bunch of talking heads.
Yeah.
This is a beautiful movie. It is a very well-made movie. And it is one that its form makes
stunningly
the content
beautiful.
All the more
beautiful,
right?
Breathtaking.
It's that question of what movies should people go out and see. It's kind of an interesting one. And I think that this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's one of the movies that of this list, you know, brought up by the Oscars that everyone should go out and see is Mad Max Fury Road. Mm-hmm. It's not a particularly important movie, unless if you care about movies, but I think that the vitality of and the kind of energy that it brings to this art form justifies our talking about movies for an hour. Am I talking about movies for an hour every week? I think that what it does with its physical props and its car chases and its acting and its action, I mean, it is just incredible and cannot be realized in any other format. So I railed against that argument for The Revenant, but I'm making it for Mad Max.
We could extend Richard Brody's argument. If The Revenant is the Trump movie, Mad Max Fury Road is the Hillary Clinton movie, right? It's let women run things.
As it should be.
So that's that argument there. But it also raises the question, you know, I was talking before about that notion of celebrating a thing when it's dying. The fear, obviously, is that the Academy Awards are celebrating another thing that's dying, which is the experience of seeing movies in movie theaters. You're doing everything in your power to keep that alive, but it lives in peril.
Right, and that's the other side of the double-edged sword, watching something on video and you're not having the collective experience, which adds a dimension to watching the movie.
Yeah, and to me, that's so important. You know, with certain movies. One of the movies that I loved this year that I understood was not going to be nominated for any Oscars, and although I really actually thought Jason Segel's performance as David Foster Wallace in End of the Tour was one of the great pieces of acting that I saw
this
year.
I'm blown away it wasn't nominated for Best Screenplay.
At no point during this movie did I think I was watching an actor. I really felt like I was watching David Foster Wallace, or at least something that wasn't somebody acting. But at the end of the movie, I thought, did they make that movie just for me? Because, like, it's got all of my issues in it, you know, and all kinds of things that I'm interested in it. And so I was in a movie theater, and I turned around to the people sitting behind me, and I said, did you like that movie? And they said, yeah, we liked it a lot. I said, okay, that's a relief, because I thought I was almost having kind of a Truman Show moment, like, maybe they just made this movie to make me happy.
It's one of my 10 favorite movies of the year. Nobody mentions it on their 10 best.
There's a New Haven tie-in with that movie, and that Donald Margulies, who wrote the screenplay, is a longtime New Haven-based playwright and professor at Yale, and has really been promoting the movie. I know at Arnold Cinema as well.
Well, he came to the theater and addressed the crowd afterwards for a Q&A. Yeah. That was the only night we did business with it.
But there's a real joy in going to movies written by people who have an ear for dialogue, whether they be playwrights or professional writers in some capacity. I mean, I'm thinking of the new Alan Bennett movie, The Lady in the Van, which is, you know, by a British playwright. And it's a very modest movie about a pretty egotistical guy. But, you know, if you have a sense of good language, it can just be a delight to sit in the theater and spend an hour and a half with a character.
We're going to take a quick break here. We'll come back with our final segment, live from the study in New Haven. Maybe even let the audience bring up things and ask, would you guys would do that, right? All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Actually, they sat there very inertly when I asked them that.
Excuse me. A high step and more, just go to the movies and
the following Oscars for technical achievement were awarded at a ceremony earlier this week, in the middle of the day, in a garbage-strewn alleyway, with feral cats yowling in the background. Best production of a radio show on the road, Betsy Kaplan, Katie Tularsky, Jonathan McPants, and me, Kyon Wolf. Lifetime Achievement Award, Gene Amatruda. Best tweeter, Greg Hill at WNPR Colin. Best performance in the role of Bill Curry, Chevy Chase. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff eating crummy snacks and watching Hot Tub Time Machine 2, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. Coming up next week, a chance to catch up on our shows about Vin Baker, Beatrice Fox Auerbach, The Sharing Economy, and Dioramas. And now, back to Colin.
All right, live from New Haven, the study on Chapel Street. This is sort of a second home for us. I bet you we've done 10 shows from this lobby by now. So we're here on Chapel Street in New Haven. We wish you'd come by, but we do have some wonderful people who are here. We're going to make it possible for them to participate in this conversation as we go along. With me up here is Arnold Gorlick. He's the owner of Madison Art Cinemas. Vivian Nebetta from the Stowe Center. Tom Breen from the New Haven Independent. We're all here talking about the Oscars, although we tend to sort of veer away from the Oscars and talk about movies in general and movies that haven't been nominated. Although maybe before we, and if there are any questions or comments or anything, we'd love to get a few of you on the air. Before we do that, though, we should say something anyway about the telecast itself. Usually I'm at a fundraising party, which I'll mention at the end of the show, and I have to DVR it and watch it later. This year they're actually trying to do something that I've been wishing that they would do for a long time, which is get rid of all these elaborate thank yous. I mean, everybody who goes up there, I'm always sitting there, if I'm interested at all in the person, thinking, please say something. Say something about what it's like to be you. Say something about what this means to you. And instead, they really are mentioning everybody who ever shook their hand in their lives. And so this year, they are offering people the chance to have that loaded in and have it come up as a crawl across the screen so they can actually say something. So, first of all, Vivian, what are the chances in your mind that that'll actually work?
It will not.
Okay.
It is a very, very valiant effort. Because also, too, think about it. If you actually win, I'm thinking about, you know, when I win my Oscar in 2018. I'm not going to necessarily look at the screen. I may not remember. Or I may see a name. You could put my mother on there and, like, I don't know who Elizabeth is. So I don't think so. I think it's really sweet. And
but
I
this to
think
take you people, off the hook. You don't have to know anything like that. It'll crawl down underneath you.
Some people won't even care. It's like you can put it right there. I'll tell you. I mean, they just won't care.
All right. So
well, apropos, my favorite acceptance speech was the shortest. It was by, I think it was Maureen Stapleton when she won for Best Supporting Actress in Reds. Yeah. And she was so stunned, she just ran up there and spit out in the microphone, "I want to thank everybody I ever met."
Right. There actually are. I think Brain Pickings or one of those sites has right now the short. There are four-word acceptance speech that people gave in the past. Things like, "Thank you very much," and they would go sit down. I don't want that either. I want to hear, like, what's going on. What, you know, say something to me that I'll remember. And I will not remember who your agent is. Don't say that. Are there people out here? Yes, yeah. Let's get the microphone over. Yeah, here you go. Let's talk right into that microphone.
Colin, a short anecdote, and I think Vivian kind of alluded to this point I'm going to make. I have a second cousin, my mom's cousin, who when he was younger was a principal at a film company, and he was a voting member of the Academy. And a couple of different years I asked him about movies he would vote on, what he was going to vote for. And I was surprised to learn there were a lot of the films, even in the Best Picture category, that he hadn't seen. And he was still going to vote for, I guess, based on the ones he had seen.
Wow.
Kind of surprising. My other comment is that as far as the Academy Awards being kind of a marketing tool and maybe not really going to quality, when we're in a culture where, you know, the most energy in the campaign is going to somebody like Donald Trump, maybe we shouldn't be surprised that that percolates up and, you know, quality isn't what necessarily gets the attention.
Well, to your first point, they have no excuse for not seeing them now because they all get screeners, right? I mean, right. This is a very transportable medium at this point. They have to see everything.
There are whole articles, though, about it, about how a lot of them don't see everything, even with the screeners. Right. And I think, what is it, the Hollywood Reporter? Somebody after the Oscars, they do an interview with an anonymous Academy person who talks about that year's race.
The other thing, Tom, that we're going to see this year is Chris Rock obviously being the host. Mm-hmm. This is a group of people who they understand, I think, that they're going to be made fun of and be rated by whoever the host is, but they don't seem to take it very well usually, and I'm wondering what this is going to be like this year.
Yeah, Chris Rock, I haven't seen Top 5, but it's one of the movies I've really been looking forward to catching up with. It's kind of his return to the limelight a couple years ago, his movie about a comedian trying to regain his mojo and his various travails in New York City. But I think everyone who talks about Chris Rock, everyone who knows Chris Rock, says that he's the smartest person in the room always. And I'm really looking forward to seeing, and I know he's hosted the Oscars before, and I don't think he made much of an impression back in 2005, but I think that a lot of weight is put on the shoulders of whoever hosts the Oscars. They have to be entertaining and interesting and you know, sharp, but not too sharp for the whole night. And I don't know, I think he's someone that I really enjoy watching perform. I think he's a really entertaining guy and really smart, so I think he'll do well.
Well, I mean, in a way, this issue has sat frozen for 2 months, right? If you don't nominate anybody, then we can't really talk about it very much, except in the very blocked way. It's a little bit like the Supreme Court. You know, if you don't nominate anybody, we can't have that conversation. And so, Vivian, Sunday night will be the resumption of that conversation. Right. I mean, they've handed Chris Rock a stick of dynamite.
Right. Well, I mean, one, I think when it comes down to comedians and who you're planning on having host anything, let alone the Oscars, I mean, you kind of know what you're getting. You don't bring somebody like Chris Rock and expect him to talk about roses and daisies and smiles and rainbows. I think part of including him is he's a smart comedian. He's a great stand-up. I'm a fan. But part of it is, you know, you do have to make fun of these people. I mean, you're in multi-million-dollar gowns. You know, we're sitting here, you know, cheering for who's the best. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But I think that it brings that experience back down for that. And I think it's okay to make fun of George Clooney or Matt Damon. Like, he's not going to lose sleep over it. He'll be fine.
They'll get it. All right. We have to stop here. I want to say, first of all, thank you to my wonderful staff who came down here with me today, Betsy Kaplan, Katie Tularski, Josh Nalea, and Jonathan McNichol. Thank you so much for coming out to the study today. Give yourselves a big hand right now, and a hand for Vivian Nevada, Arnold Gorlick, and Tom Breen. We'll be back next week with a whole bunch of new shows or perhaps shows you've heard before.
Maybe homely in your neighborhood, but if you think that you can be an actor, see Mr. Factor. He'd make a monkey look good. Within a half an hour, you'll look like Tyrone Power. Hooray for Hollywood.
I'm so excited. I am a bear at the after party for the Oscars. Ah, there's Bryan Cranston. I love him. Oh, Kate Winslet. Leo. But why am I the only bear here? Ugh. Oscar's so human.